review the minutes, meeting minutes from April. There is one addition. Kelly's name was missing from the attendees, so that's been added. And I'm wondering if you can have Jess review them.
I move to accept the minutes as written.
I second.
Well, I'm very excited to let everyone know that Debbie Hassler is here to join us. Let her give us a little introduction.
Perfect. I'm Debbie Hassler. I'm a member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. I live in Battleground. I work for the Cowlitz Tribe in our 78th Street office. I manage our Pathways to Healing program, which provides advocacy to people who have been hurt and harmed by violence, dating violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, trafficking, and elder abuse. I'm just completing my 9th year on our tribal government. I'm a tribal council member. Next month, hopefully I'll be able to tell you I'm starting my next term. We have elections in June. I am a member of our health board, which is our governing board over our health and human services department. I'm glad to be here. I learned all about public health today, so that was really exciting. My passion is really for social services, so I'm hoping that I'll have a lot of stuff to contribute, and I'm hopeful to learn and meet everybody. It's a little bit about who I am and where I come from. And I don't have any children, and I have dogs, and I prefer to have
dogs. So you need to meet our veterinarian.
Which this is probably then a good opportunity for us to all go around and introduce ourselves so that we can get to know us as well. So my name is Stephanie, and I represent a nurse working in Clark County.
I'm Paul Childers, and I represent the rest dogs of Clark County.
Mark Collier, I represent septic designers, installers, and maintenance specialists.
I'm Amy Smith, I represent the youth of Clark County.
I'm Arlene Murphy, and I represent a medical doctor in Clark County.
Hi, I'm David Scott, I work for the city of Washougal, and I represent all the cities in Clark County that aren't Vancouver.
Melanie Maiorino, I'm the behavioral health advocate to Clark County and Skamania County.
I'm Kelly Espinoza, I represent Legacy Santa.
I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I am a veterinarian in Clark County and the doctor of veterinary medicine.
I'm Don Skirt. I do communications for Clark County.
I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief in Battleground, and I represent the LEC, which is all the police chiefs in the sheriff.
Margaret Sanger. I'm the director for community benefit at Peace Health.
And I'm a symbol in the audition.
I'm Pat Shaw. I'm a program manager in public health administrator at Clark County Public Health, and I oversee the nurse family partnership and the children with special health care needs program. And I've been meaning to somehow reach to their tribe, so now I know where to find
them. Alan Mellick, public health program and health officer.
Jeff Arbison, I'm the chief administrative officer at public health.
Jim Scott, I'm the chief performance officer at public health.
Lydia Gurman with Public Health Admin Assistant.
I'm Dawn Bonder. I'm the CEO of the Southwest Washington Accountable Community of Health and your evening's entertainment, or part of it. Sally's my opening act.
I'm Sally Fisher, and I'm an outreach specialist with Public Health.
I'm Steve Becker, and I'm a consumer of public health services, but I work for Daybreak Youth Services.
Remy Youssef, and I represent the Dental Society.
So we have a couple of moments just open for comments. If anyone has something that they'd like to share that's not on the agenda, any news? All right, then we're going to go ahead and get started. As mentioned, we're going to hear from Sally Fisher, who's going to give us some information about the Green Program's orientation.
Great, thanks. Well, I am Sally Fisher, and I work in the Solid Waste and Environmental Outreach Division. So we do a lot of recycling and garbage and working with the public and trying to help them lead more sustainable lives. So My main responsibility is the, can you hear me okay? I know I don't have a very loud voice. I feel like I'm going down the line here. I guess that's what I was saying. We have an extensive website for the Green Neighbors program, and I'd encourage you to look at it. If you get a chance, it's clarkgreenneighbors.org, and that will give you a pretty good feel for what that program is about. And because it covers all of the residential outreach, it's really diverse, and there's a lot of different things going on. So tonight, I'm just going to talk about repair cafes and the Recycled Arts Festival. So starting with the repair cafes, this is a fairly new program to us, and it's an opportunity for people to bring things that are broken, and we have volunteer fixers who will fix them at these events. So we just had our first one, and it was pretty successful. We were really happy with it. We didn't advertise it hardly at all. We were so afraid that too many people would come. Because there's a lot of broken stuff in Clark County. And when it's free, free is a very good price. So, but they, we had about, and I'll get to that, but we had about 30-some people who came, and so it was perfect. And the goal of these events is, of course, to keep stuff out of the landfill, conserve resources, save money and share skills, and just build community. And it definitely did that. It was just a really great feeling when we were there, the people that came. We had over 100 volunteers step forward who wanted to fix things. We didn't have enough stuff to fix. So we can take care of that, though. That's a good problem to have. We have an extensive list of partners, as you can see. And it's been really fun to work with all of these different people. Everybody brings something different to the table, and I think it's really led to the success of our event. So in March, we had our very first repair cafe. We held it at the Habitat store that's up on I-205 in Mill Plain. We had 26 volunteers work that night, and we had 36 repair tickets, and most items did get fixed, which was cool. And like I said, we didn't do very much promotion. We put out flyers at Habitat, and we sent out a little bit on our e-list. But that was pretty much it, just to keep things to a dull roar. But we sort of figured out what it was going to be like and what the flow would be like. But with these 100 fixers who want to get involved, you know, we're going to have to step up our game. So when people come in, they register at this front table. They show us what they've got. And then we escort them back to the proper fixer who is going to take care of it. And then they have a little ticket. And the idea is that they're supposed to bring the ticket back to us before they leave, so we know if their item got fixed or not, and we have a little inventory of what happened. And for the most part, that worked, but it was not 100%. So these were all the categories of fixers that we had that night. And this guy, this was so fun. This lady brought in her old 45 record player, and I was one of the few people in the room who knew what that was, so that was cool for me. And he fixed it, and she was so excited when she left, because she had all these 45 records in them, and she wanted to go home and play them. So it's very gratifying to be there and kind of hear the stories. So you can see in the upper left, there's a guy, he was sharpening tools, and he's explaining to this woman about how that works and what she should be careful of. We had people fixing bikes, and when we didn't get enough bikes, we just went back into the Habitat store and we brought a bunch out and they fixed bikes for Habitat. So that was good. We had sewers, she's fixing a jacket down in the lower right. And then up at the top, this woman brought in a sewing machine, and it's kind of hard to see, but it was like from the 1950s. And it was the only sewing machine she'd ever had. It's the woman in the lower right corner of that picture on the cell phone. And she's in a wheelchair, which you can't see in this picture. And the guy doing small motor repair, he noticed that her wheelchair was making a funny noise. So when she got her, and she did get her sewing machine fixed, and she was delighted. And then he had her come over there, and he completely tuned up her wheelchair. The story on this toaster oven is that they bought it for $3 at an estate sale or something, and it never toasted. So it would bake, but it wouldn't toast or something. So a guy fixed it in like 15 seconds. He took it apart, he just had to put a little wire back together, and
And they were so excited because there was a red light that came on that they'd never seen before. So that was like the highlight for them, was seeing this red light come on. And then he's ringing a bell. So every time somebody left the event with a repaired item, they had to ring this bell, and we all cheered and clapped and celebrated every successful fix. So it was really fun, and people really came together around it. I just think they're great. So our next repair cafe, and you guys can start stocking up stuff to bring, is on May 25th, and it's going to be downtown at the Vancouver Community Library. So we're rounding up our volunteers now, and that's just a week from Thursday. So it's coming right up. And then there's going to be another one on August 24th at Philbin's Ace Hardware in Hazeldale. And then we're going to try to get to Battleground for the fourth quarter. But we're having a hard time finding a location. If anybody has ideas of a place in Battleground where we could do this, that would be great.
And then did you say that the one was in August?
It's going to be at Philbin's Ace Hardware, which is in Hazeldale. I don't know the exact address. And then long term, the plan is to turn this over to a group of volunteers who will take over the project and manage it and run it. And there are many successful models of that, so we think it can work. Sometimes it's hard, you know, to turn over a whole project to a group of volunteers if you don't have a champion who's really going to take it and run with it. But we do believe that this can work, so that's what we're hoping to do. And we also want to connect with the tool library. And I know there are several tool libraries in Clark County that are like halfway there. So we're going to try to see if we can get one across the finish line so people can go there. And I understand the number one most popular tool to borrow is a weed whacker. So we're hoping we can get lots of weed whackers and whatever else people need to borrow. And they can just come and check those out and do their home improvement project and then take it back. And it's really nice, especially for big tools that you don't really have any place to keep at your house, or they're expensive and you can't afford to buy them. So that's the long-term goal for that. And then moving on to the Recycled Arts Festival. Has anybody been to the festival down at Esther Short Park? Okay, we've got a couple live ones. It's going to be June 24th and 25th this year. This will be our 12th year, which is, I said I'd do it for 3 years, then I said, okay, I'll go five, and here I am at 12. The first year we had 3,000 people come. Last year we had 40,000. We had 30 artists the first year. We had 150 plus last year. We've added a sculpture garden where the artists make like a larger piece of art, and we put those down on the bricks at Esther Short Park, and then people can come and vote for their favorite, and everybody really likes to be engaged that way. We brought in food carts. We used to rely on the farmers market to provide all our food, but they closed too early, and for some reason, when the food goes away, so do the people. I have not figured out why they can't last for 2 hours without food or drink in the barn, but they can't. So we have 3 food carts coming. We have children's art where kids can do art projects. We have music going all day long both days. We have magic, still walkers, jugglers, and clowns. You guys should really all come. It's really so fun. So a lot of people ask me, why we do the Recycled Arts Festival, and what does that have to do with what you do, and you know, why would the county want to do that? And it's to create communities surrounding waste reduction, sustainable living practices, and positive consumer behavior sparked by art and celebration. And I've always tended to work out of the box, so we did try having garbage and recycling workshops and inviting the public, and on a big night we'd get 3 people. You know, it just didn't attract anybody. So we decided to take a completely different approach. And what's really great about the Recycled Arts Festival is that we get to talk to so many people that would normally, they would never stop and talk to us. You know, they come to the park and then we can deliver our messages to them, but as a rule we would never get that opportunity. So these are some pieces from the sculpture garden, just to give you an idea. Actually, they had some kind of mechanism where it was breathing fire. It's raining really hard, so they had to turn it off. And then because education is really our primary foundation, the Tustin found, and we're already working on that for this summer, is where we have somebody out at the transfer station, and they're pulling stuff that people are dumping that should have been taken to a secondhand store or given to a relative or a neighbor. And so we display all of that. We used to raffle it off, but it got really out of control, and people were like lined up for blocks just to get, you know, one free thing, and then they didn't come back. We made them leave it till Sunday, and then they wouldn't come back to get it, and so we give it to somebody else, and that's right when they'd show up. And it just became just too difficult to manage. So now we donate all of this to a thrift store, and it gets sold there. But it's really impactful when you see a whole tent full of stuff that people have just dumped. I mean, it's new golf clubs and brand new barbecues, and it's unbelievable what people throw away. We've won multiple awards. In 2011, we were the Recycler of the Year from the Washington State Recycling Association. We've twice been the People's Choice Game Changer favorite event with the Vancouver Downtown Association, and now they won't put us on the ballot because they said they want other people to win. So I'm hoping they'll get over that in a couple of years and go for that again. And then at the Washington Festival and Events Association, we received several awards. So I think just for fun, next year we're going to go for something national. A national award and just see what happens. We don't have anything to lose. Music, like I said, the White Rhino Marimba Band, they're just really fun, and they've been there all 12 years. So I said my year is complete once I've heard White Rhino play. We get great sponsorships. This is our list for this year. We're up to 22,500 in sponsorships, and there's one still available. So one lucky person can buy the sponsorship for the Procession of the Species for $2,500. So if you guys know of any businesses who might be interested, or it would be great if you'd let me know and you can contact them. And then we get about $10,000 in revenue from selling the booth space to the artists. We do try to keep that low because we have very high expectations of our artists. They have to be in that booth all weekend, and they are our educators for the weekend. We want them talking about why it's important to them to use recycled material in their art and to have that kind of a lifestyle. So, and we've gotten to know a lot of them over the years, and we really crack the whip. They have to, I have secret shoppers who make sure they're doing it. So they do get a good deal on their booth, but they pay for it anyways. This is sort of cool, a traffic sign made into a bench. I don't know where he got the traffic sign. I don't ever ask those things. And then we try to do something new every year because it's really hard to get publicity if you don't have a new book every year. So a couple years ago was our 10th anniversary, and we had the Tin Man for the 10th anniversary. And it's also 10 is what you give people on your 10th anniversary. So we had a lot of fun with that. And I have him upstairs, but he's kind of heavy and bulky, but I brought his heart. And so we did here's his heart. And we did a contest with all the artists, and they all made hearts for the Tin Man. And at the end, we donated all of those to the Heart Association, and they auctioned those off at their annual fundraiser to raise money. So that was good. And this year, Toto will be joining the Tin Man.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I had hoped he'd be done for tonight, because he's small, but he's not ready. So here's some flowers. So this year's hook is the Procession of the Species. So is anybody familiar with that? It started in Olympia, and it's basically a parade with costumes, floats, music and dancing. We've hired a marimba band, and they're going to lead the people through the streets and bring their drums, and I think it'll be great fun. And it is also a celebration of community and the natural world. And we really believe that if we can connect people to nature, they are far less likely to go out in their backyard and spray chemicals all over it. So so we have an ulterior motive, but it's much easier to engage people through a parade than through a lecture. So that's the approach we're taking. And of course, the event's free. It's open to anybody who wants to participate, but we do have three rules. No written or spoken words, no live pets, and no motorized vehicles. And I just say it's no politics and no poop. Those are the two things that we just don't want to deal with. And especially in current times, I think it's better if we just don't let anybody carry signs or chant or whatever they want to do. So we will have lots of staff on hand to enforce that. Because the other thing you have to do is not make rules that you're not willing or able to enforce. And so we've stepped up and said this is what we're willing to do this year. So this is in Olympia, and I don't know if you can see that, but it's a crab that these people are carrying, and then they've got all these really cool heads things going on. Yeah. And this is a praying mantis that I actually met a couple of weeks ago. And he was having so much fun, and he'd reach out with his little pinchers and he'd shake your hand. People just loved it, just loved it. And this is a big octopus.
Wow.
So what we're doing is we're having a series of workshops leading up to the procession. They're free to the public. We're gathering up all kinds of recycled material. And if you have any stuff at home, we take just about anything, any kind of craft supplies or bags of weird stuff you have that people might be able to turn into a costume. And we're helping the public make their masks and their costumes so they can come and be in the parade. So we were down at the Water Center last Saturday and we made costumes for the kids.
So where do we take those donations?
You know, if you could bring them here, that would be great. Janice will take them. So here's a kid. This was supposed to be a snake mask, but I'm not really sure what that is. But he sure had a good time doing it. And then here's some little bird masks. People were really creative. And the theme for the day was wetland creatures, so all of our masks were something that would live in wetland. So the last weekend in June, Recycled Arts Festival, the banners are going to go up next week. You'll be seeing them around town. Here's the crowd, all those people that we get to talk to come and see us. So I hope you'll come. I hope we'll see you there. And I'm going to pass around some cards for the festival, some cards for the Repair Cafe, and some information about the procession. And if you want to take any extras to give to all your friends, that would be great too. And that's it for me.
So I just wanted to add, when last June, when the Department of Environmental Services was dismantled, some of that department went to Public Works, and the Solid Waste Education Outreach Program came to Public Health. And that's one of the reasons we have on your agenda where it says green programs is we want the staff that are part of that program start coming to our advisory council meeting so you all can become more oriented and understanding of what they do and how closely it aligns with the work that we're doing here at Public Health. So thank you, Sally. That was fabulous.
You were probably all wondering why I was here.
No. Does anybody have questions for Sally? That was great. Thank you, Sally.
So now we're going to have an update on the nurse family partnership.
We're going to go in. I haven't ordered you, but I'm not sure. Kind of do the mental health sales tax first and then lead into that.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Mental health sales tax is actually something that the Public Health Advisory Council was instrumental in getting through back in 2006 or so, down the year, right?
Yes.
Way back, kind of related to the issues that we were seeing with the methamphetamine epidemic at the time. And you might recall that we were able to use, out of the fund balance in the mental health sales tax, $1.1 million to keep the Nurse Family Partnership going through 2017. I just want, there's a couple of things. I'm going to give you an update about the mental health sales tax and the NFP, but before I do that, I just want to talk about the mental health sales tax. This is hard to say five times fast. The Mental Health Sales Tax Task Force. I want to say tax. Anyway, Councillor Bolt has actually created a task force to take a look at how the mental health sales tax is being used.
And the criteria that historically have been applied to the mental health sales tax are that you have to be a Clark County resident, there must be a connection to behavioral health, for example, mental health and chemical dependency, and it can include prevention, intervention, treatment, aftercare, outreach, support, and support services such as housing, transportation, and case management. It can be used for newer expanded programming. It could be used for service operation delivery for therapeutic courts, and it could be used for flexible funding. So those are the criteria that are currently in there, and we're actually able to work with our board to get them to approve the use of it for that $1.1 million for the Nurse Family Partnership. Now we have a task force that's actually looking long-term as to what criteria should be used for this at Councilor Bolt's request. And we've added some additional criteria that I'll just give you an update on that. This is still a work in progress. Local funding is a pair of last resort. It's not intended to supplant for those expenses that should be part of the county general fund. Must be data-driven, should be best practice and or research-based, not a duplication of services. It has to have identified outcomes, so it has to work. It's intended for low-income at-risk populations and should align with the county's values as defined in the county's strategic planning process. So the Mental Health Sales Task Force is going to be on, we're going to work with these criteria. I think there's one that I left out, I have to fix this document. Being able to leverage additional dollars with the whatever you spend on it as well. So we'll be working on this and developing an implementation plan based on these criteria. So that's an ongoing process, and I'll keep folks updated. Yes?
So how many people are on the task force?
There are, let's see, I'm on it, Vanessa Gaston, who's Director of Community Services, on there. We have somebody from Juvenile on there. One of the judges is on there, Judge Rooley is on there, Mark Bolt is on there, and I think I may be leaving somebody out, so it's a fairly small group.
What's the total amount of tax collected?
Do you know how much is collected each year? There's a bunch left in the...
I want to say $1.5 million was the growth over the last 12 years.
Did we got 1.5?
We got it. The county collects it. We got 1.1. There was a fund balance, actually. Not all the money has been used over the years, so there was a fund balance, and that's what we got.
That's kind of what percentage we got.
So, I want to give you an... Yes.
I was curious. The last time that a group was assembled, there were lots of representatives, including education as one of the members. I know because I was on there representing 112. Is there any look at the original group of folks that represented that? And then also the suicide epidemic that is a part of our district and in this county. Today I dealt with a 10-year-old who was going to commit suicide in our district. And Denise Deshawn, who runs the Safe Schools the threat assessment process, was talking to me today about the number of elementary students who are suicidal. We just did an article with the paper about this problem. So I'm wondering about, is there an opportunity for that group to not only expand and get more voices at the table, but also are you looking at what other counties across the state are doing with 1/10 to 1% funding? And my concern is that when you attach best practice as a criteria to that, you can look at the state and their use of marijuana tax funding, and what has happened to limit what can actually be done with the funding, because that's one of the criteria.
Yeah, this is just our first meeting, and this is just an early proposal, and I don't have, I'll come back to you with what's the plan in terms of vetting it down the road. We just had a first initial small group meeting on this.
Okay.
I'll get back to you on that.
All right.
I don't have additional information at this moment, but I promise I'll bring it back to the next meeting. Any other questions about? The nurse family, so I want to give an update on the nurse family partnership, which does help prevent in terms of suicide as well as, you know, in terms of kids, it does have that preventive effect. The county supplemental budget that will be go before the board on May 30th includes $400,000 in the mental health sales tax to keep the NFP going through 2018. And we had a work session where it was board time. Was it board time or work session?
It was a work session.
It was a work session. And it appeared, I think the board is looking at this favorably. So I'm hopeful by May 30th that will be approved in the supplemental budget and we'll be able, that will help fund NFP for an additional year while we continue to look for additional dollars. The other piece about this is the next item on the agenda is the designated state health program application. So Nurse Family Partnership has a is designated as a DSHP program, which means that it's eligible for up to one-to-one federal match. So if the board approves the $400,000 for NFP in 2018, we will get an application in for DSHP, and that may bring in, we're hopeful, up to $400,000 matching funds from the feds, which will go through the accountable community of health that I think Don's going to talk about in a little bit. So that'll bring an additional up to $400,000 into the community. We're continuing to work with other partners about getting additional funding for NFP as well, and we should have more news maybe by next meeting. And I can't release any of that information yet, but that's looking positive as well. So I don't have any questions about that. Yeah, we're kind of excited about that. So, should I move on? Foundational Public Health Services. Okay. As you know, we've been advocating at the state level for Foundational Public Health Services, which are the basic essential services that local health jurisdictions provide. And there was a bill, was it 1432? I'm losing track of the numbers. House Bill 1432 defined foundational public health services, and associated with 1432 was a monetary ask. 1432 made it through the House. The House voted to support it. Got to the Senate, where it kind of stalled in ways and means. But the good news about it, even though the Senate didn't vote on it, it's now included. As you know, the legislature is in a special session. They're in their first special session. I'll probably go into a second one. The good news is Foundational Public Health Services is designated as NTIB. And NTIB means necessary to implement the budget. So even though 1432 didn't make it out of the Senate, because it's NTIB, it still lives on in the legislature. The governor proposed, now we had originally asked, local health officials originally asked for $60 million for the biennium for Foundational Public Health Services, of which 50 would come to local health jurisdictions. The governor, this is a tough time for the state because of the budget crunch and the Cleary decision and all that other good stuff. The governor proposed $20 million. The House proposed $40 million for the biennium, and the Senate proposed zero. So we're kind of hoping that when this gets through the budget process in the special session of the legislature, that we're hoping for $40 million out of it as a possibility. That's what the House had recommended, but that's where it is now, and we have lots of advocates. The County Medical Society sent a letter to each one of our delegations actually supporting Foundational Public Health Services. You may have seen we had an editorial in the Columbian, was it in April, saying invest in public health and supporting it. So I'm optimistic. And we have, I believe our delegation for the most part is really supportive of this. So that's where we're at. I'm hoping to have good news for you, for everyone next month on that. So maybe lots of good news next month. Any questions about that? Okay, what's next? Casino update. Everyone knows that the casino is up and running.
Really? Just being facetious. I noticed by the traffic that it was up there.
Oh. Yeah, I think the traffic problem is getting solved with that. I think there's issues with the one lane or something. We're working on an agreement with the tribe around the monitoring of the effluent that goes into the injection system that we already talked about, and that's looking positive in terms of some sort of arrangement in terms of where we're able to look at the data and work with them on that. So there's a letter that a letter that we've been working on with the tribe to basically say that we'll work together with them and we'll be able to see data related to the effluent. So I'll keep you posted if any of that changes. So that was my update on that. I think we may have talked about that in a previous FAC meeting. Changes in county management.
Are they on public water?
They are on public water.
So they get their water from the center?
They get their water from Clark Public Utilities, I believe. Yeah, they're on public water. They're not on well water, they're on public water. Okay. Changes in county management. Those of you who've read the Columbian know that there's a Mark McCulley is no longer the county manager. Bob Stevens, who is a director of general services, is also the deputy county manager, is not interested in the long-term job or even the short-term job. So because he's deputy county manager, he'll serve in that role and do some of the work until the county can get an interim county manager, which should happen relatively soon. So the county will work with a headhunter. They have these headhunting companies that have like retired or loaned executives, somebody who's been the county manager elsewhere and maybe retired now, and will fill in as interim county manager until the county can do a national search for permanent county manager. So in terms of its impact on us, I enjoyed working with Mark. But we're, it's kind of business as usual for the departments in the county, and we're going to continue. There's a lot of work to be done, and we'll continue to do our work. But you may have read about it in the news, and I think that, there was a lot of information in the Columbia. I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. I'm not putting anybody to sleep yet. Okay. Budget update, I'm going to let Jeff handle that one.
Alan's covered some of it. The regular session ended April 23rd, as you know. The first special session is in place now, as Alan stated. This is the seventh time in the last 8 years they've had to go on a special session, so it's becoming regular at this point. 2015, when they finished the budget, June 30th in the evening, they were in their third special session. I would not be surprised if that happens again this year. Alan talked about the things we're watching relation to the state budget, so I don't really have much else to update other than just give you guys timelines. They have to actually approve a budget for the governor. I'm sorry, the governor needs to sign a budget before July 1st to avoid a possible government shutdown. So that's the driving force, I would say. So right now we're just in a hurry up and wait.
Any questions about?
It's real neat.
So on the federal level, since we're talking about budget, since the Affordable Care Act is still, I know it hasn't gone through the Senate, just passed the American Health Care Act, whatever it's called, passed the House side, but hasn't been through the Senate, so the Affordable Care Act still stands, and the Prevention and Public Health Fund is still there because that hasn't been cut, so at least for the time being, at least we still have those federal dollars as well. We'll keep you posted. Well, you'll probably read about that as well. Medicaid expansion is still there as well.
Can I ask a quick question? And I apologize that I don't fully understand all the funding sources, but I know I read an article in the Columbian talking about how the Medicaid potential changes could impact what Sandy was referring to also with the kids and access to school nurses and counseling in the schools and stuff. Is that something that when you're thinking about the budget, is that anything that comes across as far as something that you're concerned about for funding? Because if it's not going to come from
one place? Do we try and get it from the county to have those services available?
If we lose the Medicaid expansion, so when the Medicaid expansion went through, there's about 120,000 people in Clark County on Medicaid. So about more than a quarter of our population is on Medicaid. And if I'm remembering the numbers correct, about 40,000 of those folks, I think 39,000 are folks, are the folks who were added with the Medicaid expansion. So if those folks lost Medicaid, that would be a significant impact on our community and them as well. It would be a significant impact on the hospitals because it would increase the amount of charity care that they'd have to provide, because folks are going to go to the emergency rooms. It'll probably be more adults than kids who get cut, but it'll be a significant chunk of folks who are, I mean, that's a large amount of funding that we lose and have a huge impact.
Yeah, they were just talking about how right now some of those Medicaid dollars go fund school counselors. So I always think of Medicaid as like insurance that individuals have. So that's where I was kind of wondering where. But you know, there's a lot of different pots, and I know.
Well, I think some of the agencies in town, like the Children's Center, mm-hmm. They have nurse counselors based in some schools, mm-hmm. and maybe there's some Medicaid funding tied to that. I'm not sure.
And
there absolutely is. So when you think of a house built with bricks, the bricks that they can charge for a student coming to see, Children's Center is our primary provider of Battleground, they can bill for that funding, and it's all Medicaid based, and that's based on basically free and reduced lunch. So if you think about a building and they have 70% of their students are eligible for free and reduced lunch, that's a Medicaid saturation level. But what we're talking about asking for is 0.1%, which is county money that comes in specifically what Alan was talking about earlier to fill in the mortar around those bricks. All the things that Medicaid you can't bill for, and right now the AWARE grant is paying for that in Battleground, but every single district in this county needs that, because if you have a provider like Children's Center come in and your kids, for whatever reasons exist, need additional support, they're undocumented, they can't afford their co-pays, except I could go on the list and I don't mean to, but that's exactly right. Medicaid, if it is cut, we will not be able to serve children in the ways that we are limitedly serving them now. And it's a tragic situation. It will be horrific for schools. Anyway, I know I'm spouting off here, but this is really, really important for people to understand. And Children's Center is wonderful. So, anyway, yeah.
So I think the dish fee dollars that matches Medicaid, isn't it, Jeff?
Matches, no, it's not. In fact, you cannot participate in a Medicaid program and bill for dish fee.
I had a question, it's not budget related, but did I read an article about immunizations being real low in Clark County versus other parts of the state?
I think we're lower than the state average. What I'd be concerned about is it's not uniform within the county. So if you look at it, you know, we're talking about school aid exemptions, I think is what you're relating to, you're talking about, because that information just came out about the exemption rate in schools across the state, and Clark County had the highest exemption rate. So we're talking about kids who are school age and above. We have, on the average, I believe, a higher exemption rate. People, and most of the exemptions, very few of the exemptions are religious or medical. The vast majority of the exemptions are, we call, philosophical. People don't believe in, for whatever reason, they choose not to believe in, immunizations. What concerns me is that if you look by school district and even by school building, we get to some areas in some parts of the county where you have the proportion of kids that are unimmunized is high enough to give us great concern about potential outbreaks of vaccine preventable illness. So we've seen an issue with mumps in the state. We've seen an issue with, I know that there's a community in Minnesota where the immunizations were really low and they've had a measles outbreak there, so it's concerning.
Is there something, maybe special, some education things in these specific schools, or I don't know?
Yeah, Boy, that's a good question. I mean, I think with a lot of the populations around education, a lot of the folks who choose not to immunize their kids are well-educated. Having a security issue.
There was apparently another meeting scheduled for this room, a recovery meeting, I think, and it got moved, and apparently not everybody who goes to the meeting was alerted to that, so we've had several people come by tonight expecting a different meeting in here, so that's part of the activity.
Okay. I got a little distracted. So, what was that? Oh, education. You know, I think education does help. I think that there's a lot of, I mean, we're familiar with the anti-vaccination movement. It's not like people, some of the folks haven't been in. I think we need to do more education, but I'm not sure that's enough. I think we need to think about.
Yeah, I was just concerned, you know, the herd type.
Yeah, concerned about herd immunity.
Lack of herd in different parts of schools.
A couple of years ago, we made it a little bit more difficult to get the philosophic exemption. You have to go to your provider and get a note from your provider saying that you've been educated by the provider. You know, you've heard about the value of immunization. But, you know, I think the numbers went down a little bit, but we still have a substantial problem, and it's not all schools or school districts are equal on that. You know, the only other alternative is to make it a little bit more, make a philosophical, I mean, either end them or make it more difficult. Anyway, that's where we're at.
Isn't there a measles outbreak in Minnesota?
There's a measles outbreak in a Somali population in Minnesota that historically had had really high immunization rates. There were some cases of autism in that community. They were approached by the anti-vaccination group, including Andrew Wakefield, who I believe lives in Texas. He's the guy who published that article in Lancet he lost his license and the article was removed because he produced data that were not accurate data. They convinced a lot of the folks in this community that their autism was related to the MMR vaccine, and the immunization rates in that community dropped really low. I think they got down, if I'm just thinking off the top of my head, to around 40%. To that adequate herd immunity for measles, which is incredibly contagious, you need upwards of 92, 94, 95% herd people vaccinated to prevent measles outbreaks. They were down like in the 40s, I think, and they had a large outbreak with a large number of kids hospitalized. I don't know if there are any deaths there, but we had gotten a message out because we were concerned that there are communities across the country where people would be visiting, that we have a potential risk for measles outbreak here. Measles can be deadly. I think the mortality rate is about 3 in 1,000. It can cause a really nasty encephalitis, which is inflammation and swelling of the brain, and kill you. So measles is nothing to take lightly. It's a very potentially very serious disease. You know, one thing we may think about in the future is to have stronger rules about measles vaccination than maybe some others in terms of school exemption. That's another possibility. You know, we don't treat every disease differently, but that's something we will need to look at down the road. Wow, okay.
I was at a forum once, Dr. Melnick, where this was a topic of discussion, and it was put on by a group of autism activists. The question of MMR came up, and the organizer said, but what else could it be?
Yeah.
And it's such an emotional issue.
That's causality for you right there.
That's it. What else could it be?
Yeah. The data show that there really isn't any association. I mean, a lot of studies have been done. There is no association between autism and MMR. It's really tragic because measles can be, like I said, it can be deadly.
Is the vaccine requirements for the schools federally? Or is it a statewide or county?
They're generally state rules.
Every state has their own specific requirements.
I think most of them, it's like notifiable conditions. It's pretty much pretty similar everywhere. I mean, people take, the way the exemption laws work, you know, we treat all these diseases the same. We may need to think about new ways of doing it, maybe to convince people. I don't know. Measles is probably one of the most deadly. I mean, pertussis is really nasty too. Not for the school age kids so much, but I mean, one of the things I've said to people is get your kids immunized, not just to protect your kids, but to protect everybody around them. And pertussis, if we get pertussis, we may be sick for a few weeks with a nasty cough, but an infant gets pertussis and they have a high mortality rate. So anyway, stuff keeps me up at night.
Okay, so we're just gonna move on. Everyone has a letter. So just as a reminder, Marjorie Liddell came from the Aging Commission and gave us an overview last session on kind of their philosophy and some works that they were doing. So she has summarized their policy platform and is asking for this council to provide a letter of support for their platform. So I was wondering if we could take a few moments and review that and see what your thoughts are. Roxanne, would you be able to kind of talk us through how we could offer support between whether it's us sending a recommendation or this letter to the Board of Health or how that all works?
You bet. And this will be the same thing for the ACEs Action Alliance recommendation or any recommendation that we're asked to provide on behalf of that. So the process, we've been reviewing the bylaws, and the process is not fully laid out in the bylaws, so we'll be meeting with our prosecuting attorney this week to kind of go over the process. What we've been doing in the past is that if FAP recommends that they would want to support this, we're an advisory group to the Board of Health. So that will go back to the Board of Health and our county manager, and they will either approve, either they, the Board of Health, will send the letter if they approve of this recommendation or support the recommendation, or they will allow FAP on behalf of Board of Health or on behalf of FAP to support whatever the request might be. That has been our process in the past, but it's not very well spelled out. Now with the change in management, we want to make sure that we have an opportunity to revisit that and make sure that our bylaws are updated so that, number one, we have a criteria that we're utilizing in order to make decisions. But then number two, we also have a process in place so our community partners or stakeholders or members of the public, when they're approaching that for a recommendation, they understand what that criteria is as well. So that's what we've been working on, and that will be the process. So tonight, if you all vote and want to take this forward to FAP, then we will, take this forward to as a recommendation to Board of Health, then we will work on that process, and we will get back to you at next meeting and let you know exactly kind of how that's working out, if that makes sense.
Does anyone have any thoughts on the Commission on Aging letter?
Are you looking for a motion to submit?
Yeah. Or, if you had any recommendations for or any concern areas where it makes you hesitate or, just open that up for discussion. A motion to approve or to support?
I move to approve.
Second.
Right,
so then
Roxanne,
let us know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can
I
ask I'm sorry. Yeah. Blame the new girl. Can I ask a clarifying question?
Absolutely.
So you make a motion and you second, but you don't vote?
Would you vote? I noticed
that. So
too.
You move and second, but you don't you don't vote?
All in favor.
I'm standing opposed. Right.
So I'm muted.
No.
I have no decorum, so absolutely.
I was just, it was new, and so I was like, what happened to the vote?
Okay. Yeah, we stuck up really fast.
And as long as that came up, just as a little procedural kind of point is,
after someone makes a motion and then it's seconded, then it's opened up for discussion. And then when that ends, then you can just ask, you know, all in favor.
Okay. Super. Does anyone have a further discussion? You want to say all in favor?
I was wondering if you could clarify the motion. It wasn't clear to me what.
I move that we submit this document as presented in support of the Council on Aging request.
To Board of Health, is that what you
mean? To the Board of Health.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
I'll learn. I'm sorry.
Have to ask if anyone
opposed. All opposed.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm staying.
Mr. Roberts came up with all these different
things. Okay, then the next thing is to discuss the possibility of going dark in August. So in the past, we've done that. We've not had an August meeting. There's been a lot of conflicts with either back to school, family vacations, whatever. So again, just wanted to see what your thoughts were on going and not having a meeting in August. So the same process for that. Does anyone want to
move that we not have a meeting in August?
Yes.
Second.
Second. Okay. Now any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Then you can say one. And you can just say so moved. If you want to.
I need a gavel.
We'll have to get you a gavel.
Make it really exciting.
There you go. All right. Great. Okay, the next thing then is along the same lines as the Commission on Aging. It's from the ACES Action Alliance. So they are asking this council to sign on to the op-ed. And so we wanted to discuss that and then vote on that. And you should have that op-ed attached also in your documents. So Debbie, would you like to have like a brief synopsis of ACES, or do you know what ACES?
I know what that is.
Okay.
Thank you, though.
When they say op-ed, does that mean editorial? Or? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what ACES Action Alliance is requesting is that FACTS actually sign on as a support for this op-ed that they are producing. This op-ed, these recommendations, so the ACES Action Alliance has been doing a lot of these community events. They've screened the Raising of American Films, and they've been having community cafes all around and having listening sessions. And so this is what has come out of those listening sessions, and these are recommendations that they're putting together as an op-ed. So they're asking that, and again, the process will be that if you would like to support this, then we'll go back and we'll get the permission, and it'll be either Board of Health that would sign on to this, or they would give that approval to be able to sign on their behalf. So that would be what the process is. Once you guys decide if this is something that you would want to support in the board.
I mean, you could do both. You could ask the board not only to approve you signing off on this, but you could ask the board to have them sign off. Okay. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, either one or both.
Mm-hmm. I would think both would be great.
Second.
All right. Awesome motion, Mark.
Okay, I make a motion that we endorse the op-ed and submit it. I guess we'd submit a draft letter to the Board of Health. To the Board of Health.
Asking for
their approval.
Yep, their approval. To sign on themselves or to let FACTS sign on? Or
I would say ask for both.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think this is a kind of silly question. What is an op-ed?
It's an opinion piece.
So it's an opinion piece just specifically for?
Yeah, it allows other people in the community to submit an opinion piece. In this case, this is going to be directed first probably to the Colombian, okay. And if they don't pick it up, then it would probably go to Reflector or another paper.
Okay. And what they want is that they can say the bottom supported by.
Right.
And I mean, like we talked about, I do feel like we need to find out what our bylaws are, because it does seem to me that it's a lot of work for you guys as employees to figure out how to make sure that that's, because as we keep doing this, people are going to be like, well, we should be, we're a great program too, and this needs to be supported, and you guys are running back and forth, and if it's not even in our bylaws and we're doing something more out of our realm of work that we're supposed to be, then we need to make sure that
it could water down our endorsement.
Right, exactly.
As well.
If we're supporting every great cause that it that there is, then but I mean, obviously, ACES was a big thing that we were working on, and we've been working on, and Commission on Aging, I think, as well.
See, the op-ed is a little bit unusual. You know, your role is generally to advise the Board of Health.
Right.
Well, it is to advise the Board of Health. That's it in the bylaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So putting yourselves on op-eds is a little bit different from that.
And that's not what the Commission on Aging is.
No.
That's
no.
Just to show that we support the Commission on Aging platform.
You're letting the Board of Health know that you support that. Yes, correct.
But this is more kind of this is going to be more like an editorial base.
And if Roxanne, isn't that what you're going to be talking to the prosecuting attorneys about?
Exactly.
I don't know
right.
How we would even do this. If it would be, you'd make a recommendation to the Board of Health that they support us, the fact, I mean, we don't know how this.
I'm just trying to think of letters we've done in the past. Which ones do we take to the Board of Health? Or we've done letters that we haven't. So what's the distinction? What do we do and when we don't? Or if there is a distinction?
The only ones I remember are recommendations to the board. I don't remember, unless anybody else here, I don't remember that FAC has gone out and done an op-ed or taken a position on something. I just remember asking the board to take an action on something, or recommending, but I don't recall FAC itself taking a position, unless, as long as I've been around, I don't know what everybody else remembers.
And to your point, that's why it's going to be important to really lay out those criteria, because, and that you know, Janice and I were talking too. I mean, I think as this group, more and more people start learning about FAC and what FAC does, we're going to start having more and more and more requests that come your way to review. And so I think it's going to be very important to have that criteria and to have a very good process that is vetted so that we know what our roles and responsibilities are and what we can and cannot do. And we need to update our bylaws so that they're a little bit clearer with regard to that.
Don't we also need to know the proper place to send things?
Correct.
That aren't under our, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if it's not under our purview, then we can either recommend, well, you might want to try this or that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we certainly need the criteria for us so that you know kind of what those parameters are.
Not, you know, on this one, on the turnaround, Tom, I don't know when the op-ed is planning to go in, but there's a process. If you have a recommendation for the board, we can't get the board to convene on a dime. I mean, we have to get it on their agenda, basically.
It sounds like this is something, because I'm pretty new to this group too. Sounds like this is kind of a new kind of request. And
right.
I wonder, and because we don't know, when something like this goes to the board of counselors and we're making a request of them, they can say yes, no, we're different. And it is a public meeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as public as an op-ed that goes out in the newspaper. And so one thing that we might want to, because I totally support this ACES thing 100%, but I also don't want to set a precedence that then could put additional demand on us to express our endorsement in a particular way. And so maybe in addition to the criteria for what kind of a request would we vet and what are the mechanisms by which we want our voice to be heard? And it may be something that we want to think about before we, as much as I really like this, is that maybe we just think about that piece before we do this.
Yeah, your primary audience is the Board of Ed. That's your main audience.
If I have that correct.
So I have a question. This is me trying to figure things out loud. So I have read this in 13 seconds. This is the Bible that I received 2 hours ago. So if the one of the purposes of the council is to advise the Board of Health on providing communication between the Board of Health and the citizens of the county, I feel like it would be in our best interest to take a stance on, yes, we agree that this is a public health issue, or a broad statement, and we give that statement to the Board of Counselors and they say yes, so they're buying off on something that we said this is important, but it's their decision to buy off on the content. We're just telling them that they should think that it's important. Mm-hmm. So because they're communicating with the citizens. Mm-hmm. So I think that we just like pass the information along, and it's really not us to sign off on or buy off on at all.
Middlemen.
That's what I think.
Well, you guys were created as a way of getting. We're no longer a health district, so the fact was to be created to get the input to the board that the board no longer has, because they're a board of counselors and not a broader board like the old health district board was. So this is an opportunity for you to, as a diverse group of Clark County citizen representatives, to get representing a variety of disciplines as well as to get the best thinking possible to the Board of Health.
One thing that I remember that Mark said at one of the meetings that they all attended was, the question was asked, what can we do to help them? And he said, push the issues. If they all didn't agree with it, push the issues.
Well, they want to hear from what you guys think are important. Yes.
Well, maybe an alternative, we could endorse this statement, and then the Board of Counselors could be the author of the op-ed if that's what they choose to do.
Or sign on.
Or sign on to it, as opposed to us signing on to it. That might, I'm not sure if that would be a little bit more politic, but another alternative.
I kind of like the idea of us, even though we're pushing it and they're agreeing with us, but for us to be listed, or Clark County Public Health, Advisory Council, as well, as because I think the more this group is known, or more influence we can have.
So one of the things we could do is it sounds like there is a consensus, but we need to probably discuss it a little bit more. There potentially is a consensus that we support the content of the op-ed piece, and we support the work of the ACEs Action Alliance. The question is, how do we go about actually providing that support for ACEs Alliance for this op-ed? What is really the process? So I think being able to say that there's fact does support this, but we really need to work out the process, and maybe that's what we do.
I'm wondering what the timeline is. Do they really need something from us?
So
fairly quick, and then we go ahead, take care of this, right. And then go ahead.
I think the timeline.
They've done a lot of work.
Yeah, the timeline. The community cafes just finished, and they just provided this to us within the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. So I do think that they have some time for this, and I'm actually meeting with the prosecuting attorney on Thursday, so I think I'll have some good information back then. So I think that we can move fairly quickly on this if we need to. I don't think that we'll necessarily need to wait to the next meeting, and I can certainly provide information back to the executive team to back in the interim. So I don't know if that would work for everyone. Alan, do you have a suggestion?
Well, the only thing, the board of meets as a Board of Health only once a month.
Correct.
So if we were to get approval of the board this month, we'd have to get it on the agenda tomorrow before you met with the prosecuting attorney. And we could get it on the agenda, and they could, that would have been an open hearing. I think we have to get the agenda in tomorrow.
We've gotten board approval for firing outside of the village.
Okay, and how did we do that? Did you
I think it's the county manager.
Which?
I don't know.
We have the deputy county manager filling in, but I gotta tell you, he's doing the best he can, but he's also got a department to, this is just bad timing. He runs the Department of General Services, which is a full-time job, so it's gonna be a little bit of a bottleneck right now, so this is probably not a great time to test that, but we could try getting it on the agenda.
I guess my impression is not that urgent that it has to be on this.
Yes. Okay.
I think we have time,
I think probably what the motion needs to be, though, is more around if the council will support the FACT executive committee in moving forward with whatever
that's a great point.
The decisions made. I think if the full advisor council says the executive committee can do something with this, that's where we could maybe save some time.
Yep, that's a great idea. I'm not sure we'll get it on the board soon, but
isn't it,
who's on the executive committee? Good job, Ross.
And Bob.
I haven't been to a board of health meeting, but is it something that you could ask in the meeting as a, this is what we're looking for, would that be, how would you want to
next week we have to get it on the agenda tomorrow, because
it's not like a comment section at the bottom where people can say, yo, I've got a question.
Yeah.
Much more formal.
Yeah, you have to get, for the Board of Health, you have to get the information for the hearing at least a week ahead of time. That way, there could be opponents out there, and they have the right to show up, and they have to be able to see it. There's a public notice.
I was just thinking, if they had an opinion on how they would want us to, what would be the easiest for them, and how, you know, that we're getting more things that are wanting to be brought to them.
I think I agree with Janice that we may not make the deadline on this particular one this time, but I think this is a good example of something that we could work out talk to county prosecuting attorney, talk to the counselors, and see about the best way of doing this that would work. So we may not, I'm not sure what the turnaround time for this op-ed, I don't know when they want to get it in, but
I don't think that it's real critical that we get it in within the next couple of weeks. It's just that these community cafes just finished up their work. And so I do think that it's something that they want to share with the community probably within the next month or so, I would imagine. I did not get the feeling that it was really imminent that they had to have a really quick turnaround time on this.
If you vote with to give the executive committee the leeway to do this, because we meet with them a little bit more frequently, we might even be able to get it. The Board of Health meets once a month, but the Board of Counselors meets every week. There may be another way that we can get this in front of them quicker if we need that, but we'll be able to do it quicker if...
I think I made a motion, and I can modify my motion to take in Genesis' recommendations.
That's what I try to do. I try to take her all the time.
Whatever Janice says.
I've learned that, really.
You haven't, though.
So you need a, I think you need to answer a second.
So, but I just want to make sure that I understand. So the idea is, then just to confirm, that if you are in favor of the process of learning more from the prosecuting attorney, it seems like if you say you're saying you're in favor of the content at this point, and we're going to learn the procedure.
What I understand the motion, if I got it correct, that you guys support the content of this op-ed. You're giving the executive committee in the interim the opportunity to work with us, and we're going to work with the prosecuting attorney and figure out how to get this in front of the Board of Health, for either their endorsement or both of your endorsements on it. I think that's what I heard.
Yeah. Okay.
So, as part of the motion, working with the prosecutor about this specifically, because I thought the working with the prosecutors about bylaws, which is outside of the motion, right? So it would just be to support the content, let the executive committee work in the interim with public health to get content to the board and leave the prosecutor out, because they're going to talk about process.
So I think whatever, by getting this, by figuring out with the prosecutor how to get this, the prosecuting attorney to get this from the board, we'll make this work, but we'll learn about it. We'll use this as an example to learn about the process. That'll be a side of that. What we learn in terms of getting this in front of the board through the prosecuting attorney will be a side effect that we can use if this occurs again in the future. Does that make sense? I'm not explaining it.
No, it makes sense. I just think it, respectfully, I think it makes a pretty long motion. So I was trying to shorten your motion because the process of working with the prosecutor has to happen regardless of this, because I'm assuming you want more support around your bylaws.
So if the motion is just that we work with the executive committee to get it in front of the board, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because however you
that's
do
great.
That,
and then, you're right. The other is the methodology. You're,
right.
That sounds great. Okay. You're
and
right.
And then you're less, you know, what if you don't get to the prosecutor and you make a decision and you're tied to something?
So. You're absolutely right, yeah.
Did you get that?
Hey.
Okay, so we have a motion. Did we have a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed?
Okay. Wow. Good.
A lot of
that was
Okay, so now we are very happy to have Don talking to us about the Southwest Washington Accountable Community of Health.
Okay. Thank you.
Yay, Don.
Okay, why am I holding the glasses? If you put them on, they actually work better than if you hold them in your hand. Quick show of hands before I start so I know how, thank you. How many folks in the room are familiar with the Healthier Washington initiative from the state and Accountable Communities of Health? All right, we're in a mixed group. Okay, that helps. Sorry to those of you who will have heard some of what I'm saying before, but we're gonna take care of those who have not. So I started today thinking about coming and speaking with you and deciding that I really couldn't put into words what conceptually I understood public health to be. I looked it up and fished through and got some different little snippets that I thought captured what conceptually was in my head, but I couldn't figure out how to put together an articulate sentence to say it. And the reason I put this up here is because I want us to think about it as I'm talking about accountable communities of health. And hopefully, if I've done this right and I communicate well, you'll see that accountable communities of health are an incredible tool to get into what public health is actually intended to be and do. And you can tell me at the end if I pull that off. So this all starts with a state initiative of Healthier Washington, which comes out of a bunch of legislation the state had been passing in consecutive years. It's a big program, but it all comes down to three core strategies. The first is integrating how we meet physical health needs and behavioral health needs. So right now we treat them in separate silos, and we really want to pull them together and think about how we treat people as a whole person, and not just snippets of different symptoms and diseases and conditions that go off in different silos. The next thing we want to focus on is how we pay for services. Right now, we pay for services on what's called a fee-for-service basis. You go use a service, you pay for it. Tends to make the need for more services, because if that's how you get paid, you think about how am I going to keep getting paid? If providers could be paid on a value basis, paid for the overall quality and value of their services, we probably could get a better result, both in quality as well as cost controls. And lastly, it's about building healthier communities through collaborative regional approaches. And that's where the accountable community of health comes in. So trying to define an accountable community of health is also a little amorphous. It really is just a bunch of folks in a geographic area, lots of different sectors of the community who come together with one common interest, and it's to improve the health and health equity of all of the citizens in the region. ACHs work collaboratively. It's about pulling in lots of partners across lots of sectors. Really focus on building a regional health improvement plan, so very data-based, and then jointly implement or advance with partners in the community health projects, and also go back and advise state agencies about the policy pieces that really aren't working and the changes that we need to make in order to continue to improve health in our area. So I said all that, but if when I click this button it works, the video does a much better job.
How can we come together to build stronger, healthier communities? How can we solve regional health issues at a local level? By building accountable communities of health. For years, community-based coalitions have worked to improve health at the local level in Washington State. However, these coalitions wanted to be stronger and do more to reach their health improvement goals. So, Washington State and local community organizations have partnered to form Accountable Communities of Health. Accountable Communities of Health bring together community members and organizations to work on shared regional health goals. ACHs are important partners in supporting practice transformation, value-based purchasing, and the use of performance measures. Washington has 9 ACHs operating across the state as part of the Healthier Washington Initiative. Each ACH aligns with the state's Medicaid regional service areas, and together, all counties in the state are represented. Through local partnership and collaboration, ACHs can better respond to the unique health concerns of their regions. A key responsibility of an ACH is to identify the assets, needs, and any gaps in health within a community, and find ways to work together to address the needs. Regional health improvement plans help to advance the triple aim goals: better health, better care, and lower costs. ACHs provide feedback to each other as well as state agencies about their community's health needs and priorities, helping to transform health statewide. Accountable Communities of Health coordinate systems to address aspects of health at both the community and individual level. ACHs collaborate with providers to connect patients to social supports, helping support patient-centered, high-quality care. ACHs are building a culture of whole person health in their regions. Clinical care determines just 20% of a person's health. More than 80% of health factors relate to housing, nutrition, education, income, access to care, and more. ACHs make up the 100%. That is why ACHs bring together community services, social services, and public health efforts to address the needs of the whole person. When communities work together, the result is a healthier Washington.
That was so short, sweet, and to the point, wasn't it?
Did they do a great job?
And I was talking just as fast as he
now
could.
Now I have to figure out how what I do with
it. Try this to stay.
Okay, and we should be able to get to the next slide, right? Stop. So, I thought that really sums it up, and the biggest takeaway from that, I hope you keep in the back of your mind, is that the health system, what we call health care, only makes up about 20% of what actually determines whether someone is healthy. And the other 80% are all these other factors that we talk a lot about and we recognize as issues, but we find it really difficult to get the consensus and the drive to put resources towards to really make improvements. So ACHs are based on the fact that if we can bring all of these partners together, we can take advantage of all of the knowledge and relationships to drive change the way we know we really want to see it happen. And we allow those involved at the local level to focus on what they actually do really well and connect it all together. So we're all really in our sweet spot for doing what we do best. And we facilitate collaboration both on the clinical medical side as well as those social factors, the social determinants of health, housing, nutrition, employment supports, education. These are all incredibly tied to whether or not folks are going to be healthy and maintain their health in the future. So there are 9 ACHs in the state, and I've had to kind of do my own little cut and paste there, because we started out as just Clark and Skamania counties. However, Klickitat was a transitional county, and they've transitioned to be working with Southwest. So we're now 3 counties, but I can't get someone to fix my map just yet, so it works. So that gives you a little bit of a picture of the big ACH and how it fits in with Healthier Washington. I'm going to come more local now and really just talk about what's going on here in our 3-county region. So this organization used to be called the Regional Health Alliance. So some of you may have been familiar with the work of the RHA. They've been in this community working on a lot of these issues for about 7 years. And they applied to be certified as the Accountable Community of Health once that program got running in the state. And we've changed the name because it was a lot of confusion, and now ACHs are a much more visible entity across the state because we are working on what's known as the Medicaid Transformation Demonstration Project. I'll get to it. And so we decided to just be Southwest ACH and make it easy for everybody. One less acronym. So this demonstration project is going to provide one component of the resources and the framework for the work that the ACH is going to do. And basically that project is, raise your hand if you do not know what the demonstration project is. Okay, we've got some hands. I'll do a quickie. So the federal government funds Medicaid to the state, a good portion of it. And usually that money comes very prescriptive. What it can be used for, how it can be used, what programs it can be used in. The state of Washington applied to the federal government for what's called a Medicaid waiver. And that asks the government to just give all that Medicaid money to the state over 5 years and remove the restrictions on how it can be spent and allow the state to craft its own view of, if we got this money and used it on our Medicaid beneficiaries in the ways that our local communities are telling us is going to best serve these communities, we're going to get better outcomes for that money. So the government agreed, and it's a contractual process. The state promises certain outcomes over 5 years, and the money flows through that 5-year period through this demonstration project. And it's called the demonstration project because essentially we're gonna demonstrate that if regional communities get their dollars without those nationwide restrictions, we do better outcomes, costs, and quality. So I really shortened it up. It's pretty complex how it all comes together. But this community stands to benefit by getting a lot of money for our providers in our community, both our healthcare providers as well as our social service providers, to really shift how the system works. And we're starting with focusing on our Medicaid population. And so we will be the convener and help organize the community to come up with the projects that we're going to work on that's going to drive this change and get the outcomes that will ultimately result in dollars to the community. So part of what we're going to do is really look at how do we better align the resources and activities that we already have going on in this community. There is a ton of amazing work going on. It's often not communicated and aligned really well. So in some areas, we have folks working towards the same issues, and they don't know what each other's doing. And in other areas, we just don't have anyone working on it because everyone thinks someone else is doing it. So part of the project is to really do an inventory of our needs, and then compare it to what do we actually already spend money on and have people working on, and what's working. Let's take that, pull it aside, and figure out how to leverage it and make it grow. We're also going to be focusing on health equity. We have a lot of health disparities in this community. There are populations that have much lower health outcomes than others. And there's lots of reasons for that, which we can begin to understand by really talking to the people in the community and understanding why things are working for them the way they are or not working for them, what is keeping them from taking advantage of services that are offered, how do we fill those gaps community by community and level the playing field for everybody. And lastly, we really want to support regional and statewide initiatives that underlie shifting how the system works. So in particular, what we're going to be doing is asking for healthcare providers to do two really tough things. One is to make this shift from working in their silos of what they were trained to do and educated to do, and for many, and most of them have done for many, many years, of I'm a physical health primary care provider. I'm a behavioral health provider. I'm a substance use disorder provider. We're gonna ask them to forget their silo and come together and communicate with one another and work across those lines, because we know that no one segment of the medical profession is able to solve all of those problems. And we've left some segments out. We know we've left out oral health at the moment. We've left out drug management at the moment, but incremental steps. Let's get the physical health and the mental health and substance use disorder all in one basket, so they start to really look at someone as a whole person and what do they need among those services. While we're asking providers to do that, we're also gonna ask them to shift from their payment cycle. So right now they get paid, they bill for a service, they get paid from the insurance company. Even for Medicaid, we have managed care organizations which act as insurance companies for Medicaid beneficiaries. So a provider does a service, they bill for it, they put in a code, they get paid. We're going to ask these providers to come together and start being paid more on the value. Are they hitting certain outcomes? Are they hitting certain measures? Are they aligning the work that they're doing with our needs overall? We were talking about immunization rates earlier. I was listening. I didn't look like I was listening, but I was listening. You know, if we want to increase immunization rates, one great way to do that is to have providers more engaged with talking to their patients. So how do we get them to do that? And how do we incent them and reward them for spending time doing what, as a community, we value? Well, if you, as a provider, get your immunization scores way up, that will require you to have more time with these patients, and you should be paid for that. So there's a whole shift in how these providers will be paid. So we're going to be working on both of those pieces of the healthcare system at the same time as we're going to be working on connecting the services that support people outside of the medical system with the medical system. So when someone's in a doctor's office or a counselor's office and they're struggling with, you know, food insecurity or job loss and job insecurity or education issues, there will be coordinators that the doctor can use or the provider can use to get those people connected. So we're not going to send these people back out with a phone number to try to figure out how do I connect with this system for every need that I have. So it's a big change. It's an ambitious vision, but it really, if you think about it, pulls all of the pieces together, and if we're successful, it will really enable us to greatly improve the outcomes. And people say lower the costs. I'm not sure we're lowering costs, but I do think that we will have smarter spending. I think that the money that we spend will actually provide quality and value and improve people's health and lives, rather than having the most expensive system in the world with mediocre outcomes. So the fully integrated managed care, our region was an early adopter. The state has required every ACH region in the state to shift all of the payment for both physical and behavioral health services to the Medicaid managed care provider. We've already done this in the region, and that's part of why the county is no longer involved in a lot of the mental health services, and part of this shift. I have a feeling that Alan, you can tell me if I'm right, but this body is a result of early adopter?
Yep.
So really moving the county out of being a service provider and allowing those services to come through the Medicaid managed care for both physical and behavioral health. For doing that, on the being the first, we will actually receive additional dollars through this demonstration project to help support providers in doing those changes that I explained. Because it's hard. That's hard work. It costs providers money to make those types of changes, and we have to help them with that if we actually want their participation. So we're special because we were first. We're still the only, and probably will be for another year. So as we embark on really rolling up sleeves and getting into designing the work under this demonstration project, we are really using our regional health improvement plan as the focus of our work. Really looking at both the upstream and downstream strategies, working on not only the healthcare delivery system and how we help those providers transform their practices, but also making sure that the social determinants are being connected to the healthcare system. This should all have a great impact on population health. That's the goal. We'll keep our fingers crossed. We also hope to really have that data and the voice to make policy and system changes. One place in particular, I know just sitting here now, we've got an incredible housing crisis in this region, and this work isn't gonna solve our housing crisis, because we can't build housing, we can't go out and force people to offer affordable housing. So being able to show all this work is continuously hitting a boulder when you get to the housing issue will give us the data to pass up to policymakers to use to then figure out how do we find resources to solve that problem. And lastly, really keeping in mind that if we don't address health inequities, that we're always going to have folks that lag behind, and we're never going to get everyone up to that level playing. So this is just a diagram that really drives home that the plan is the center of all of our work, and everything we do is going to come back to what needs does that plan demonstrate, and how do we use all of our assets, the governance, the data, community engagement, evaluation, and shared learning, making sure that we're learning lessons and tweaking things as we go and not just blinders on, full speed ahead. And then finding ways to take savings and reinvest them into the community. But it all comes back to, what does our community need? And what resources do we have? And how do we leverage all of that to do the work we really want to do? So our region's ACH has three impact areas. And for me, this is where the link with the public health piece really kind of, the light bulb went off. Health equity through prevention and health promotion. We all know that if we can keep people from getting sick, it's going to cost us less. And they're going to be healthier and live more productive lives. We all know that if we can keep people from dangerous situations, we're all going to benefit economically, morally, ethically. And the data's there. We just need to figure out how do we do it. We're really working towards that whole and culturally appropriate care delivery. We know there's folks in our community for which they just don't click with our system the way it's built. And we need to adapt the system to figure out how do we meet needs across the board. We can expect people to change and adapt to our system, but I think we could all look around and say that's not working that well. And lastly, we really need to have adequate access and systems that work at full capacity. If we have systems that are, you know, overloaded on one side and then with excess capacity on the other side, we're not using our resources effectively and efficiently, and that's a really poor use of our resources. So this is a horrible slide. I'm really sorry. I'm not a good slide maker. But this gives you a little bit of an idea of what the project, the Medicaid demonstration project, is asking us to do. So up here, no, I didn't want you there. Up at the top where it says require tactics embedded in each initiative, that's where we're gonna be working on showing how each of the projects that we do comes back to a value-based payment approach. It has some kind of workforce development in there, and it really has a system for population health management. And the state's built this project toolkit, they call it, into two main buckets. Projects that have to do with care delivery redesign on the left, and projects that have to do with prevention and health promotion on the right. So on the care delivery side, every single ACH is required to do the behavioral health, physical health integration project. So that's the one we've already started working on, which is how do we get all these into that whole person view. The second required project every ACH will be doing is something to address the opioid epidemic in the state and to approach it regionally. Then we're required to pick at least one project from each of those sections. On the care delivery redesign side, our Regional Health Improvement Plan Council has already chosen the Community Care Coordination Project. And so that's where we're going to be linking up those social determinant of health issues with the rest of the system in a coordinated way that has a technology backbone to it, so we can really be sure people are getting the services that they need. And then we will be choosing over the next month one project from box four, a minimum of one project from box four, and potentially the rest of the projects, depending on how we can make them all come together, what needs we have in our community, and how we can marry those to the resources that we have. So it's a lot of work, and it requires a lot of collaboration and cooperation from all sectors of the community. So our ACH is structured so we have a board of trustees that oversees the entity. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so we function just like any other nonprofit organization. And our board of trustees has got the fiduciary responsibility to make sure the organization is financially stable and functions within its mission. We have, the board has three committees, an executive committee, a finance committee, and a nominating committee. And then there's me, and then one day, there'll also be someone who helps me. Any day now, not on the chart is, we do have a finance person. Thank goodness, nobody would trust me keeping track of things. But we have a really small staff at the moment, and we are just embarking on starting to build out the staff that we need to actually make all of this come together. But we also have an idea of how to use all of the pieces of the community that we need and try to get their voices in, so we have both a top-down and bottom-up approach. So the Regional Health Improvement Plan Council, known as the RIP Council, that dark blue line there, 25 folks of all different sectors across the three counties that we serve. And those folks are going to be responsible for trying to weave all the pieces together. Then I'm going to flip down to the bottom, because we have a data and learning team, and they support everybody. That's a lot of information flowing through there that gets analyzed and given back to the various groups, so that we can really be making decisions based on true data and information rather than just what we think might be the case. And that's, you know, been very eye-opening to actually look at the data and see where our community has needs. And the way that we're assessing needs is, you know, on these measures, where do we score compared to other communities in Washington, the state as a whole, the nation as a whole? And really trying to pick out those places where we have a lower score, substantially lower in some places. One place that we have a really low score is in teen pregnancies, 15 to 19 year olds. We have one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the state and the nation. So those kinds of statistics start to get to the point where you say, okay, how do I link that back to some of those projects, and what categories can get connected back to we want to reduce teen pregnancy? After, we have work groups that are going to be really in the weeds. These are the subject matter experts, a clinical integration panel, a community care coordination group. And then on the right is the, we call it the opioid plus, because we know we're going to be doing an opioid project, but we don't know yet what other projects we'll be doing. And those folks are the subject matter experts. They work in the field. They know how all the pieces come together. They will be working to define the critical elements that go into these projects. We then are going to do a reality check with both our business community folks, who actually have an incredible perspective on how the gaps in our system affect their employees and what they see as employers with trying to meet their employees' needs, and our community voices. And the community voices is actually taking this stuff back into the communities and going where people meet. Going to their churches and the elementary schools and their gatherings and their social clubs, because usually folks, especially in the Medicaid community, they're not going to take 3 hours. They can't take 3 hours out, travel here, and sit here in a room with us to tell us a story that we really need to understand, or to tell us that the plan we just devised because we thought it sounded like it made sense actually isn't going to solve their problem. So really want to make sure we have that reality check. And by doing that, it all comes together and comes back to the council, who weave it all together, and then it will go to the board for final approval. And we need to do all this work and get this all done and submitted to the state by October 23rd. Nobody asked me if that was a good idea. So just to give you an idea of the timeline, so this project began in January when the federal government signed off on it. We have just submitted, I like how it says that March, it was supposed to be the submitting of the application phase. That was due yesterday. We have submitted our application to be certified by the state as an ACH to participate in this demonstration. And then we'll have another certification phase in July. We submit our project plans, that's now moved out to October 23rd. And by the end of the year, we will be notified how much money we've qualified for and when that will flow. And the hope is that in January of 18, we will be starting implementation. So that's a lot of information, and most of you are still awake. That's good. So I'll just open it up to questions, because I could keep talking, and if I'm not connecting for y'all, that's not going to help.
I just have a quick question. So adding in Clickattack County, are they now under the same MCOs, or are they using?
No. It's going to be interesting, because Clickattack County did not integrate.
Right.
That was part of why they broke out and became a transitional county in the first place. But we're just going to have to figure that out. It's going to be interesting.
But the goal is that it'll be included in the project plan, so in 18.
They had to be included in an... So the state thought transitional counties could just stay out from the demonstration,
okay.
And the federal government said, oh, no. All your people have to be attributed to an ACH. So then it came down to, where did it make more sense for Clickattack to be? In Greater Columbia, which is to the east, or in Southwest? And they're already in the Southwest region after 2020, after integration is mandated for the whole purchasing. So it just made sense to take them now. And we're actually gonna try to push them to be a mid-adopter so that they go a year and a half early. I think there's some appetite for that now. Great question.
This could be a silly question.
There are no silly questions.
Thank you. Is there already a regional health improvement plan that we can look at, or that is what you are creating and updating?
We are creating it and updating it now. There's an older one that was done for another one of these projects called the SIM grant, but the data and learning team is really refining that right now and getting more current information and really looking at the data that ties initially to the pieces in that project.
So then when that's done, we'll have access somehow to see that?
Yeah, we want to share that widely because we want to start to align everybody's efforts around the same major points. So for definitely.
Other states that have similar, is this other?
Other states have done these Medicaid waivers, and they've done them in different ways. So Oregon's doing one. They have what's called the CCO model, the Coordinated Care Organization model, very different. New York has done an ACH model, but they allowed the health systems to really be the focus instead of the community collaborative. So there's some elements that we can pull from and say, how did that work? How didn't that work? But it's a very different flavor. New Hampshire is about the closest to where we are, but they're not that far ahead of us. So we're not like able to just say, oh, how's your first 3 years going?
So the funding is still, so some people are using that funding.
Some states are still doing it the old-fashioned way, and some states are, more and more states are moving towards applying for these, especially under the current administration. Is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about eventually moving to a block grant, and this sort of is a block grant.
Yeah, that was my next question. So what's I mean, all this work, and what if something drastic happens?
So when we ask these questions to the state, which we do often, so the state is relying on the fact that we have a signed contract with the federal government for 5 years. So we're already through half of year one. So we'll really be working on this for 4 years. It's a contract, and you know, there's provisions in it for canceling it, but none are because the government changed their mind. It's because you guys blew it and didn't do what you were supposed to do, not we just decided to do it differently. So we're gonna really rely on that. The other piece is that unless they eliminate federal funding for Medicaid, we'll still be getting federal dollars for Medicaid. The question is how much,
right?
So if they drop expansion, we lose 40,000 heads just in Clark County. That will impact the number of dollars available through any program because we get paid per Medicaid head. So the ultimate value of what are we all still trying to grasp is, I think, a question mark. The fact that we get to do it in this manner, I don't think is a question.
You guys have a plan if, you know, all, like a plan to, I mean, I feel like this is somewhat of a reality that we all have to deal with in the next 4 years.
So the state, of course, is very committed to this. The state actually started a lot of this work before the federal piece came into play. So one would be how much of the, you know, all states are grappling with that, right? If Medicaid expansion goes away, how much is the state going to step up and plug that hole? So that's one question. You know, how do you get those dollars back? You know, that's a tough conversation that we'll have at a local, you know, not only a county, region, statewide level. But right now, we're just trying to get as much work done as we can while the dollars are here to stop the momentum.
Don, what's your vision for the projects? When you're looking at projects in these various buckets, what is your vision for those? And obviously, you have some pretty steep timelines to demonstrate outcomes, right? So
the good thing is that I have visions, but I don't, it's not up to me. I have ideas, but it's really up to the folks who are doing this work in the community. Marla is on our board. We've got folks from Peace Health and all the other systems that sit on a combination of on our work groups, on our council, on our board. We have the community-based organizations. We've got the Council for the Homeless and Vancouver Public Schools and Early Childhood's in there. Some, I mean, criminal justice. So all these folks come to the table. And so we had a council meeting this morning and we did breakout sessions where groups of folks just went around the room looking at all of those optional projects, figuring out where the gaps are in the system based on their day-to-day experiences and trying to do this work. So we're really starting to see where we could make the biggest impact, and that's gonna come back for discussion and negotiation and see, you know, how do you match it with all the objectives in the project? And then what I didn't put up there, because sometimes it sounds really crass, but you only get paid incentive dollars for reaching certain outcome measures. So really this is a game about how do we match the work we want to do to the outcome measures that receive payment, get those dollars into the region, leverage them to do the work that we want to do, even if it may not be tied to one of the chosen outcomes. So it's really a little bit of art and a little bit of science.
Can you give some examples of like a good outcome?
So one of the main outcomes that runs through all of these projects is reducing ED, emergency department visitation. Awesome. Another one would be, I'm trying to think, so one is lowering the number of low weight babies. So, and in the behavioral health ones, it's a lot about, again, ED, hospital readmissions, So they're
measurable.
Very measurable. They're, you know, they'll have a starting point. You'll get your baseline. You know, you'll be required to increase a certain percentage each measurement period. And each time you do that, you'll be entitled to take
more money. So each doctor wouldn't get like the same really sick person that keeps readmitting, and then the other doctors get the healthy ones, and they're like, well, I'm going to get paid because my patients are so much. They do what I say, and then the other doctor's like, well,
no, I don't. I mean, we haven't really gotten to the details of how those incentives flow, but I think it'll be very group-based because there are so many factors we can't control. And it's folks working together, right? It's not just one. We don't want to reward one provider because they hit their outcomes if you have five who didn't, because, you know, you're really working on the system, not the individuals.
So Don, this is a lot of this is being formulated now. We're going to get you back in.
I can come back. You want me back? Okay. Thank you.
I would like to have you back.
I can come back. Yes.
I don't know if everybody knows here that Dr. Melnick's on your group council.
That's right. Dr. Melnick's on our
council.
I'm
really quiet, so it's easy to. But in answer to your question, you know, when you build in the metrics, you can look at associated risk factors. You can look at who providers are seeing, and you can also look at change in health status over time. So there's lots of ways of getting around what you're talking about. I mean, yeah, people could try to game it. Well, that's what insurance companies do, right? They look at the least adverse population to cover, right? But there's ways to address that in terms of how you look at the metrics.
See, that's why we have, he's on our, well, and public health as a whole, Roxanne and Dr. Melnick and some of their staff have been incredible supports to the data and learning team, really bringing forth a lot of analysis and a lot of insight into the raw data. I mean, because we can look at, you know, numbers or numbers. You have to have some context to really understand what those numbers are telling you and how you really see them. And the example I give, because it was a huge aha for me, sorry guys, you've all heard this, was, you know, if you look at the number of homeless people who are also addicted to opioids, it's pretty high correlation. And it's really, you know, probably pretty logical to think, well, if you're drug addicted, you're probably going to have financial issues. You very likely will lose your housing, and that's, you know, how you end up homeless. Well, that does account for some folks. But the thing that blew me away was understanding how many folks are actually homeless because they were living in an apartment and they got evicted and they couldn't find another home. And they didn't have any way to get any shelter, so they started living in their car until that didn't work anymore, and then they ended up living in a tent, and they just decided it was too painful to live like that, so they turned to drugs because it's a coping mechanism. So it's not always the logical explanation that you think it is. You really need that context from folks who are in working on the ground with these issues to say, well, you know, that's one possible explanation, but why don't you consider some of these as well? And that's where you really start to get to the how do you solve the root problems, because you really understand them.
You know, the epidemiology mantra is that correlation is not causation.
Right.
So I was wondering if we could invite Dr. Melnick to provide us updates as, you know, through Don. I know that we're running out of time for this meeting and I want to respect everyone's time. Would that be something that we could offer?
Well, we can both come back. I mean, we'll all be here, but.
Right. So you can give us updates.
So oh, God, yes. As long as Don lets me continue to participate.
Oh, that's okay. I'll let you. And I am happy to come back to a future meeting and update you. That would be great.
Thank you.
Yeah, then we'll have fun stuff to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
So, is there a motion to adjourn for the evening?
Oh, sorry. Can we do really quickly? Can we just get a quick update on daylight?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I'll make it quick. I promise. Yeah. I'll give it a couple of minute update, and my friend and colleague Lydia is going to send out the invitation to everybody. I started out my career in radio and television news business. And one of the first things you learn in the news business is if you're telling a story about homelessness, you go talk to a homeless person. If you're doing a story about traffic safety, you go talk to a victim of a traffic safety accident. If you talk about addiction, you go talk to somebody who either is addicted or comes from an addicted family. So I'm going to personalize this issue today and tell you that I come from a richly addicted family. My father was an incredible alcoholic, a high-functioning alcoholic, a well-meaning alcoholic. But my family and my life was forever shaped by the fact that my dad was an alcoholic. A lot of connections were made when our son was 15 and attempted suicide. And what we figured out at that point was that my dad was depressed. That generationally in my family, depression had always been there. My dad was of a generation of people who dealt with it themselves. He just drank. That's how he solved his addiction problem. That's how he dealt with depression. Thursday at 3:00, we'll be cutting the ribbon on Daybreak in Brush Prairie. For the first time, we will have 20 inpatient, gender-segregated girls' treatment beds. We will have 20 inpatient boys' drug and alcohol treatment beds. We will have probably two or three detox beds, two or three evaluation and treatment beds, and then somewhere between 10 and 12 mental health beds for teens. These are short-term mental health beds. These are kids who come in an acute state of mental health stress or trauma, and it's a place where we can get them stabilized and understand what's going on. Frequently, kids with mental health issues, as you pointed out, Don, they self-medicate. And when you can find out what that underlying cause is, it's a great pathway to understand their addiction. You are all invited. Thursday in Brush Prairie, Lydia's going to send out the details on this. We look forward to seeing you there. If you're not able to make it, I will give you a tour anytime. Lydia's got my contact information. I would be happy to give you a tour next week, next month, next year, anytime. I will leave you with this thought. Several years ago, I worked with Governor Gregoire's office, and I was on a tour of the penitentiary in Walla Walla. And I declined an opportunity to go to the death chamber, so they took me to the library instead. And outside the wall of the library, at the Walla Walla Penitentiary, are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these cheap little 8.5 by 11 dot matrix certificates. And I asked the superintendent, what are those? And he proudly said, those are the GEDs for the 293 inmates who this year graduated, got their GED while they were incarcerated. And I said, so if we'd done a better job of keeping them at school, we could have kept them out of prison? He said, Steve, it's worse than that. 80% of everybody who's incarcerated in the state of Washington has a drug or alcohol addiction issue. 50% have a mental health issue. It is our belief at Daybreak that if we can get to kids early, we can increase the chances they will end up in school and not in prison. Hope you can join us.
Should we
have a motion to adjourn?
I move that we adjourn.
Second.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking. Thank you for coming. That was quite interesting.
Oh, okay. I always wonder, it's like, is anyone really
there? Absolutely.
It is.
Are you finished with your cup? Thank you.
Yes.